Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This is Paul Hawksby.
And Andy Jacobs.
And this is the H&J Daily with some of the best bits of this afternoon's show. Well, obviously, Andy reflected on Chelsea's defeat to Arsenal last night. Quite level-headed,
yeah. Oh, yeah, really enjoyed it.
Yeah. Omid Jalili is a big Chelsea fan, and he was there, not just there in the stadium, he was sitting amongst all the Arsenal fans, so he talked us through that hellish experience last night. Tom Gilby is a wine connoisseur and marathon runner who did the London Marathon having a little sip of wine at every mile and trying to guess what they were, so he told us about that. And former TalkSport producer Andy Clark popped in. He's now the boxing commentator for Sky, and he's written an excellent book about knockouts in the sport he loves. So all that, bits and pieces, here it all is.
Good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon,
Andy. How good afternoon. And I'm not going to... People think, oh, you're going to go mad, you know. I'm not going to overreact. I mean, this is just what this team is. So last week they won 6-0 and ran, you know, the best team in the country. Well, I think Arsenal are the best team in the country, but they, you know, you could make a case for City. Ran them really close, should have won the game. Last night, as soon as I saw the team he'd picked, I just went, I said to Jason, that's 0-3 minimum. And
what did he get wrong then?
After the first goal, I put a bet on 5-0.
I mean, I know you did. You won. You got a 5-0 bet. Andy.
Well, I just knew. What
did he do wrong with the team? Could he have picked anybody else?
Well, he should have played Chalobah for a start. I mean, honestly, the recruitment at Chelsea is so poor. You know, just look at Badashile and Disaster. I mean, they really are a right pair. I mean, they had Chalobah and Colwill. What on earth did they buy those two for? Yeah. You know, I just... Badashile, he's as worst of players I've ever seen. He really is right up there. I don't even think he's good enough for the, you know, Ryman's, whatever it is.
Don't think it is the Ryman's
anymore.
No,
I don't think it is. National League South.
Blue Square, I think it is these days.
I ought to say, though, you know, yeah. Arsenal. I thought for a long time Arsenal were going to win the title. Yeah. I thought they were excellent last night. Yeah. They got that early goal, which they needed, you know.
But then you had that, when they didn't get the second, yeah. I think they were getting
a little bit... But that's Chelsea all over. If you don't score when you...
If you scored
at
that
point... Yeah, but we don't score, do we?
I mean, I'm not saying you would have won it, but I don't think it would have been 5.
No, it wouldn't. And, you know, the 1-1, the crowd would have got a bit edgy.
Yeah.
You know, Disaster had a chance to score. You know, Jackson, as usual, had chances to score. Mm. Fernandes, who can't hit the target, whatever happens, he had a chance. He's a real problem, I think. But it's so much to do. Anyone that thinks it's Poch, all these fans on the website, Poch out, Poch got to go, Poch. Honestly, find yourself a new sport. If you think he's the problem at Chelsea, find yourself a new sport to follow, because
look
it is
further upstairs. You think?
Oh, I think look a lot further upstairs. You know, it's the recruitment. It's they've done a couple of things, and the other thing to
so
say.
So you're saying
is,
they've given him a completely unbalanced squad that's no one
well,
could
it's,
work with.
It is slightly out. It's yeah. Basically, I mean, no one wants to hear the excuses, but they have had 10 players out every single week. Other player teams have injuries, but not so consistent and so long.
They have still got quite a deep, expensive squad. Part of the recruitment is you bought lots of players.
They've bought wrong.
They
you can't say
wrong,
that.
But you do have bodies. You
but,
do
but
have
they're
players.
They're not the right bodies. They're not the bodies. You know, if Arsenal, like last night, if Odegaard and Rice and three of their back four weren't playing, which was the equivalent of what Chelsea had to deal with, do you think that game would have been 5-0? I don't think it would. You know, I mean, Arsenal were excellent. Odegaard was wonderful. But, you know, he's their best player. You know, you take him out of the team, it's like you take Palmer out of the team. It's going to affect you. You know, it was a difficult one to take, Havertz scoring twice. I talk about rubbing it in. That's difficult. You know, but as I say, no one wants to hear the excuses, but there are excuses, there are reasons.
So you heard what Danny just said with Jim and Simon.
Right. Of course, if you can't see, honestly, I remember Arsene Wenger's 1,000th game.
Yeah.
Chelsea won 6-0. This was, you know, and Chelsea were in the ascendancy. Arsenal were on their way down, and now it's gone the other way. It will switch
cyclical.
Back. It's cyclical, and I do believe that there are enough decent players in this team if they can keep them fit. You know, I think Colwell is a great prospect. I think he's tremendous. I think even Fofana before he got injured looked great for Leicester. Hmm. You know, these two are much better than these two. I do think. For me, they're the problem. I mean, some of the, you know, Cucurella, you know, they bought too many poor players. There's no question about that. And yeah, they bought some good ones too because it's very scattergun. And
so enough good ones in there if they then buy the right players.
Oh yeah, there's enough good ones in there. Well, they don't need to buy a lot of players. They need to sell a few. They need to sell a few that they've bought, not just the youth products that are actually. Like Chalobah is a lot better than those two. They talked about selling him. He's miles better than Badashil or. Disaster, and when he came on, it looked a bit more solid. But as I say, you know, all credit to Arsenal because I thought they played really well, you know, and they could smell blood. And once they were really on it, and you know, what can you do? Half time would have taken 1-0 at half time, you know.
At least you were able to watch it from the comfort of your own armchair. Unlike Omid Jalili, who's going to join us shortly, who took a ticket to the game. Sat among the Arsenal fans.
Yeah, it was a massive error.
Right in the belly of the beast.
If I'd have done that, as soon as I saw the team sheet, I'd have gone home. Honestly, you can't go to Arsenal. And the other thing where Poch is to blame, I think, and you saw what Unai Emery did.
Yeah.
You know, he changed his tactics. He sat back and he absorbed a lot of pressure, got a bit of luck, and then he took his chances. Whereas, you know, it's a bit like Postecoglou, you know, and he's like Bielsa, Pochettino, they've got this way of playing, they're only going to play that way, they're not going to do it differently.
No.
And if you try and go toe-to-toe with Arsenal without your best team, without your best players, you're going to get smacked, and that's what happened.
Yeah, I can't deny that. It's kind of slightly crossed my mind after last night, ahead of the game on Sunday, but because we'll go out windmilling like we always do.
Yeah, you'll get beaten.
Well, there is a danger of that, indeed.
Yeah, but they will... I don't think they'll go so gung-ho. They will sit back, like they do often away from home. They sit back a bit, Arsenal, hit you on the counter. They've got every... You know, they've got a lot of weapons. They've got, a lot of confidence.
Absolutely. Well, we'll see.
Oh, the other thing is, not one goalkeeper between them, these people bought. You know, the two keepers they've bought. They don't make a keeper between them. They don't. You know.
Really? I thought he made a couple of good saves last night. He didn't he?
The first goal. He should never be beaten there like that. Never. That's poor goalkeeping. It was a good shot by Trossard. He took it quickly, but he hit it hard. But, you know, he should have been more of a barrier.
We want to get you involved in something today, and it comes from my old writing colleagues on TV, but David Quantick, screenwriter and indeed music journalist from back in the day, and he started a bit of a thread on social media today. And it's these kind of bombshell things, often that your parents would hit you with over the years. You'd be chatting about stuff. And Dave says, my dad once flew on Concorde. The flight was delayed that some fellow you like played some songs on his guitar. Pull someone, it was awful. Yes, my dad attended an impromptu live acoustic session by Paul McCartney in an airport lounge, and he hated it.
I don't believe that story. Who looks at Paul McCartney and goes, that's Paul somebody? That's ridiculous.
He didn't say Paul someone. That was his dad. His dad was not at all into the Beatles, and this would have been very early on, I would imagine. Okay, blimey, everybody's getting it today.
Sounds unlikely.
Yes, and so a whole thread is built along those lines from people coming up with stories that their mums and dads just sort of suddenly slow. Oh, yeah, I remember that. I managed to do that. I saw them. So are there sporting equivalents? One has just popped up from Robin Asquith, the star of the Confessions film many years ago.
Oh, yeah.
So he once sat on a plane in the centre seat between Tommy Doherty and Stevie Wonder.
Wow.
It sounds like a Tommy Cockle story, doesn't it?
That's fantastic.
The Hawksby and Jacobs Daily Podcast.
Not easy for any Chelsea fan to watch last night as they were humbled by Arsenal. Wasn't easy to watch at home. Wouldn't have been easy to watch from the away end for the Chelsea fans that went there. Certainly wouldn't have been easy if you were sitting among the Arsenal fans. And when I was kind of thinking of how you'd be today, I saw Omid Djalili, comedian, friend of the show, post out, and Chelsea fan, post out a little video of himself in among the Arsenal. Great look to camera. Yeah. Lauren Hardy-esque with the scoreboard at 5-0. And we're delighted to say Omid is prepared to put himself through it again. He joins us now. Hi, Omid.
Hey, guys. Thank you. That was, it was just to try and give a bit of humour to the proceedings, because it was an Arsenal fan sat next to me just said, your face is just, he'd already taken the video. Then he just said to me, sorry, I've got to post that because that's just hysterical. Because it was just the most abject performance I've ever seen in the history of supporting Chelsea. So you had to laugh about it.
How did it come about? How did that ticket come about? Was it sort of offered from someone you know? And what made you say yes? Did you think you could go toe-to-toe with them last night?
I have a bunch of comedian friends who go, and they never want me to go with them. There's people like Ian Stone, Alan Davis. They all sit together. And there's one friend of mine who's not far from them, said, look, why don't you come with me? We'd reserved the Arsenal-Chelsea game for about, I think, 6 months. And we went there. It's a lovely area. You can have food. I had a nice burger before, and there's lots of banter. In general, the Emirates is a great atmosphere, and the fans are North London boys, all fine. They all recognise me, and they're like saying, you know, aren't you a Chelsea fan? What are you doing here? And then afterwards, there was all this kind of mock concern about Chelsea. What's going on there? And people trying to give ideas of how they can help. I mean, it's like, it's ridiculous. So I started tweeting. It made it even worse.
It's such an overreaction, really.
But is it though, Andy? Because look, you and I remember, I don't know if you were at the game back in March 1986 when the last London derby, we got drubbed by QPR 6-0. And that was a surprise. Although we'd lost 4-0 to West Ham a few days earlier. It was the Ides of March. Do you remember? We lost 4-0 to West Ham, then we lost 6-0 to QPR. And I like to tell Chelsea fans, don't worry, it's a blip. But Chelsea were relegated two years later. So that was a real problem. But last night, it didn't surprise me. And that's where 38 years ago, it surprised me. It didn't surprise. In fact, I even told all the, they go, what's your predictions? I said 5-2. And they said, do you really think you get two goals? I said, no, but I know Arsenal are going to get five. And that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, they should have had two goals. But you know, when I say overreaction, you know, I'm talking about they won 6-0 last week against Everton. They ran City really close. They should have won the game. You know, there were reasons why they lost like that last night. And Arsenal are a really terrific side. Going for the title, they were right up for it. The worst thing that could have happened, an early goal. You know, the keeper should have done better. And once that had gone in, with the side he'd picked, it was fairly inevitable it was going to happen. Like, there's a danger in overreacting, I think.
It is, but when you're at the game, that's why I love going to the games, because first of all, I really got a true appreciation of Odegaard and Rice. And when you see them up front, they really are Rolls Royces. They're wonderful footballers. And if anything, I hope Arsenal win just for those two blokes. And also Leandro Trossard, as I tweeted, is a very underrated player. We'd talk about him more if he didn't look like a medical student who's done too many kind of night shifts at Middlesex Hospital. He just always looks like he's knackered. Yeah.
He's a bit dark around the eyes. It's true. It's like he's a junior doctor. Mm. He's had an hour's kick. It's true, isn't it, really?
Yeah, no, we talk about him more. But having said that, when I say that was the most abject performance I've ever seen, is because you can see there's no movement. Every time Enzo had the ball, you saw that front line. Madueke didn't look like, I mean, Arsenal fans were impressed by him. I said, he's not doing much. And then Mudryk, who I even, as a joke, I tweeted that the more he's around, the more I realise it was the fact that Chelsea bought a Ukrainian just to wind up the ex-Russian owner. But actually, when I see him, when you see these players up close, I think, are they that bad? But there was no movement. It looked like they didn't want to be there. And the most disturbing thing was, we're just literally behind Pochettino. And I like him. I want him to stay. I think he should stay for the rest of the season. But he genuinely didn't look like he had any ideas. He didn't look like he didn't care, but he just didn't know. He was like putting his arms like that. Even he seemed baffled, but didn't seem to have any power to change it. And that is the thing that really upset me.
Well, he hasn't got anywhere to, you know, Jackson, I think, did all right, but he did that typical Jackson performance. He played well, but he didn't score. Mm. He had three chances. He didn't take them. You know, it's difficult. Who's he supposed to bring on instead? You know, the recruitment's been so poor. Sterling. Sterling drives me mad.
Oh, my God.
300 grand a week for that. I mean, really. And they're stuck with him. There's no way they'll be able to get rid of him. Mm. Who's going to want him? He's, you know, he's a shadow of the player he was. So, Mudryk drives me mad as well.
Oh, Mudryk.
He's just so annoying. He's just got no football brain whatsoever. Mm. Yeah, he's quick and he can. He's got skills in his feet, but actual positional play, ideas, all that completely missing. You know.
Something needs to change there. I mean, for a big game, I know Arsenal had the big, you know, they'd lost to Villa, that they had something to prove. And
if Ødegaard and Rice and three of Arsenal's back four weren't playing, would that game have been 5-0 last night? It wouldn't. I think Arsenal may still have won, but I don't think it would have been that. It wouldn't have been that sort of thrashing if Palmer and Gusto had played, if Reece James was fit. You know, it's a big ask for Alfie Gilchrist. He's a good young kid, but he's, you know, that was impossible for him in that position. You know,
he played well though. Gilchrist played well.
Yeah, he did all right. He did all right. But you know,
but it did seem like a suicide. But that back four, I just thought, well, this is the game. They just want the one out the way, and they're going to try and win some other games to try and scrape seventh place. But in general, I really was disappointed that there was no movement, there was no ideas, and you can see Enzo Fernandez is a good player, not in that team. You know, Nicholas Jackson, he was always bought as a reserve, and Nkunku's been injured. He was never meant to be the first choice. And he just, you know, he needs time because he's only 22. But there's something seriously wrong when you show up at the Emirates with that kind of performance. It was like, I mean, I can't believe that the Arsenal fans weren't cheering. We want six. They seemed to be happy with five.
And they were being nice to you, Omid. That's what it was.
Yeah. They were being nice to me. But the only argument I had when Ben White scored the fifth, I went, oh, he meant that. And they all turned around and goes,
even
no,
he knew
not.
He didn't mean it. Yeah.
Because, no, he did. That was the only argument.
It just summed the whole evening up there, didn't it, really?
Yeah.
It really
did. But if it's true, we talked about Mudryk there. Imagine Mudryk in that Arsenal team. If you slot quite a few of your players, Fernandes, you slot a few of those players and dump them into a structured side that have had a couple of years to build.
Oh, that's my point.
They're not bad players.
No, it's completely different. But if you put Badashil in the Arsenal team, they'd be relegated. He's absolutely the worst player I've ever seen in my life, honestly. I never want to see him in a Chelsea shirt ever again.
So you had no regrets, Omid? No regrets about going? No, you're pleased you went? Or
absolutely. I should never have gone in the first place. A complete waste of time. I was depressed. I kept thinking I was just all night texting Chelsea friends who were like just so upset. But having said that, I have to say, because I'm a Londoner, and at the end of the day, these are my North London brothers, I actually enjoyed being with the Arsenal fans. There was nothing but friendly banter. And the best thing, when we noticed, we looked over at the Chelsea end, there was one bloke with a Champions League trophy who was holding it. We could just about hear a strangulated, you know, we've won it all. We've won it all. We just started laughing.
That kid with a sign as well, honestly. These adults that give these children these signs are irresponsible.
What sign?
Well, it just said, I don't want your shirt. I just want you to play for ours. Handwritten, gave it to his... Should have held it up himself.
Entitled brat.
Should have held it. Well, I mean, it wasn't the kid's fault. Dad made it, I'm guessing. Yes, I don't think it was his words. What are you up to comedy-wise? You're touring at them. You got some gigs coming up. Have you ever going?
Yeah, big international tour. Going to Canada in May. Then I'll be in Australia in September. America end of September. Then a UK tour, October through to the beginning of December. Go on my website, omidjalili.net, and get your tickets.
The Hawksby and Jacobs Daily Podcast.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time.
For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
The Hawksby and Jacobs Daily Podcast.
In the meantime, Andy, is there anything else you want to discuss?
Yeah, well done to Jude Bellingham. He won a prize at our old favourite, the Extremely Pointless Laureus Sports Awards.
It's very glitzy, isn't it?
As Roger Moore memorably described them, for sporting achievements.
He did say that. The great sporting achievements. That's right. Tremendous. You've never forgotten that one slip of... I mean, Roger Moore's great career in TV, knitting patterns, but not necessarily in that order. And then, of course, as Bond and in other fine work, and all you remember him for is saying the word achievements.
I only ever watched the first one. It was so pointless. They do it every year, but
yeah.
I can't see
that. Okay, well, you're never going to get an invite now, Randy.
I was fascinated by
Did you like Jude's suit? You're a bit of a style counselor.
Ridiculous.
Double-breasted, quite loose-fitting, bell-bottom kegs.
Trousers, yeah. Well, you know.
You weren't keen?
Not really, no. He can get away with it, though.
You can carry it off, because I was saying this to Charlie yesterday. Yeah. Charlie would look ridiculous.
My legs are too short.
That wouldn't look very good.
Talking of outfits, see, Scotty Scheffler won the RBC Heritage Award trophy, rather, on Sunday. And he picked up another jacket. It's like a tartan. You think, I'll get your own ideas, honestly.
There should only be one jacket.
Yes. Who wants a tartan jacket? It's got no allure to it at all.
Was that... So, for winning this tournament, you win the tartan jacket?
Yeah.
Is that... Okay.
Well, you obviously win a lot of money.
Oh, yeah.
They just win a tartan jacket.
So, I didn't enter it for the jacket, really. I just needed a tartan jacket. So...
yeah, tremendous.
Are there any other sporting...
Achievements
where you win a jacket? I can't think of any others, can you?
I don't think so, no.
Okay. Well, let's ask the listeners, shall we? Yeah. Maybe you go for a jacket at your golf club. I don't know. Maybe there's jacket to be won in the lower reaches of sport. If you want to share that with the class, we'd love to hear from you.
Talk about a relegation. It's like a straight jacket.
Talksport.com. Text 81089. Tweet to TSHNJ 03717223344. Shocking news, Andy, which could really get me into trouble. Using the phrase "back in your day" to an older colleague could be age harassment. Apparently there is a story doing the rounds today where somebody sued a colleague for saying the phrase "back in your day." Blimey, you'd have a few quid off of me, wouldn't you? Although your day's not that lot different from my day.
No, Alan gave it short shrift on breakfast this morning. I agree with him. It's ludicrous. These people, this should be thrown out of court. How can you sue somebody for that? It's honestly pathetic.
Okay, you're in that kind of mood today.
Well, it is. It's poor, isn't it? I was fascinated by the seagull screeching champion.
Yeah,
well done.
I saw him on the box last night. He's amazing.
Cooper Wallace from Chesterfield,
the man with two surnames.
Very much so.
He's at school at the moment, the young lad, and so we won't be chatting to him. But
I know him, actually. He walked past me and nicked my chips. That's quite upset about it, wasn't it?
I suppose that's the downside of it, for a nine-year-old to come and nick your chips when you're walking on Brighton Seafront.
Is he a Brighton fan?
I don't know if he is or not. I don't think so. He lives a fair old way from Brighton, doesn't he? Yeah, he lives in Chesterfield, so that would be a schlep. But he often hangs around the bins at the town centre. Of course he doesn't. But no, I saw his mum interviewed last night on the telly, and she said it was like we just got on everybody's nerves. But then we realised it was a really good impression. So he's gone off to Belgium to the World Seagull Imitation Tournament. I know. It's hard to believe, isn't it? The EC Goal Screeching Contest. And he's come back with the prize. What an achievement. Amazing, isn't it?
Goal! That's the South American.
Goal at the Emirates, Mike Beauville. That's right. Yeah, it'd be one of those, wouldn't it? Yeah.
Yes.
But well done to him. But we're not talking to him, unfortunately, today. Yeah. We did ask you earlier on, I was telling you, the little bombshells that people drop. We did love Robin Asquith, actor, saying that he once sat on a plane in the middle of Tommy Doherty and Stevie Wonder. That's. I'd be telling that story every day of my life. This is like about 1,000, and some people reacted
journalist and screenwriter David Quantick online, who was telling similar stories today, these little bombshells. One of them said, I once played football on the beach at North Berwick with Rod Stewart and the Faces. My dad didn't even bother to take a picture. Fantastic. So they were getting some good one of those today.
They're Birch winding me up. It's the last thing I need
to do. Of course
today.
He has. Thanks. Been. Of course he had. Mark Bertram, QPR fan and former player, giving you some clog.
People have been comparing Nicholas Jackson's hair to his, actually. Mm.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure he'll thank you for that. Matt says, my granddad had an old army pal in the Midlands called Doug, who kept saying to him, why don't you come down to Aston Villa and watch us play? And he said, oh, no, I can't be bothered. I'm more a rugby man. It was Doug Ellis.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the granddad telling the son, the grandson all those years on.
So that's anyway. Incredible.
One of those little bombshells. Talksport.com, text 81089, tweet TSHNJ. Anything else?
I love a headline explained where yes. the tabloids don't think that the listeners, readers rather, are clever enough to know what's going on. So the headlines was about... Jerry Horner and Mel B's frosty reunion.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
The headline was, Say You'll Be Over There, because they were sort of, you know, separated. Mm. At the end. And it says, a sore set of the Stars, who had a second number one in 1996 with Say You'll Be There. Yes! You know that. What's the point?
There's really no point putting it in there, is there?
I know. There's another one with Celine Dion as well.
And do you think the PGMOL are now just deliberately winding Nottingham Forest up? Because David Coote's going to be doing the game between Luton and Wolves at the weekend.
Yeah.
And David Coote is a Notts County fan.
Is he? Really?
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, it's not good, is it?
Just to wind them up. I think it's doubling down. It's saying, you know, question our integrity and that's what we'll do. I think we're all looking forward to, well, I say that. I know my wife isn't, who says it's the most boring programme on earth.
I'll have to watch it for the first match time. Officials, I've never watched it before.
Match officials mic'd up. It's going to be a hot ticket next week. I'll tell you that.
Yeah, that'd be interesting.
Because they'll be going through the Forest decisions, I guess. Or maybe they won't. Maybe they'll just blank it, not thinking it's worthy of a conversation. I don't know.
Well, you never know.
The Hawksby and Jacobs Daily Podcast.
I'll talk a bit of boxing now and a new book which I'm very much enjoying. It's by one of our former colleagues here at TalkSport, Andy Clark, who these days is a fine boxing commentator, brings you many of the commentaries on Sky. And he's taken on what he calls sport's most decisive moment in his new book, The Knockout, looking at the knockout in boxing from every conceivable angle. For those knocked out, those who've done the knocking out, from the trainers, from the referees and promoters and everybody else. Andy Clark joins us. Good to see you, Andy.
Great to see you two as well. I was just saying to you off air that 20 plus years ago, I used to AP on this show every now and again.
Oh, they've all been through.
They've all been through. They've all gone on to bigger and better things, apart from us. Yeah, basically, just stayed here.
And the very first piece of boxing commentary I did was for a feature that involved our dearly beloved Gilo. Mm. And I had to mock up some boxing commentary. And I remember listening to it when it went out and Andy saying, oh, Andy Clark there, one of our football reporters, doing some boxing, maybe. You know, maybe there's a career in that for him.
Wow.
Prophetic words.
You've often been a talent spotter, Andy, haven't you?
Yeah. I should be a football scout. Yes, yeah. A better job than the ones that we've got at Chelsea, but there we go.
So, Andy, the knockout you have taken, as I said, it's a nuanced read. You've come at it from a lot of different angles. What was the catalyst for writing this? Is it something that's always fascinated you?
It is. It's this just incredible moment in sport that can't be rivaled really in other sports, where you've got this enormous difference between winning and losing. And you can say that about moments in other sports, but it's just not the same. Mm. It just isn't the same. And the mentality of winning and losing and how you cope with either one, how you prepare yourself for either one, how you get over it if you've lost, just the overall mentality of a life spent living in those kinds of circumstances in such an extreme sport is something that's always really fascinated me. And I just didn't really feel like anybody had gone into it in real depth. You know, what does it feel like in that moment to knock somebody out? And what does it feel like to get knocked out? Which, as it turns out, is a question that cannot really be answered, because if you're knocked out cold, some fighters might feel like they remember pieces of it, but actually they don't. They're memories that are inserted after the event. But in the case of Amir Khan, who was my kind of star performer for this, he got all but knocked out cold by Bradis Prescott, but not quite. so he remembers most of it. You know, what does that feel like? And they're much more willing to talk about it than people might think, because for them it's just something that can and almost certainly will happen to you at some point if you fight for long enough.
We were talking, weren't we, off air, that attitudes to knockouts have changed, haven't they? Now it's...
There's a fight of welfare and concerns for that in a way that if you listen to a lot of the old American commentaries, no one's saying he's not moving, get the doctor in, everybody's concerned. There's no, you know, everybody's lost in the moment. I think that's a kind of fine balance that you have to tread when you commentate. You've got to get the excitement of the moment across, yet just be aware of what's going on with the other fighter who's down.
That's it. And you do allow yourself to get lost in the moment, but really only for a moment or a couple of moments. And then you have to respond to what's actually going on in the ring. And that's one of the most interesting things about it. It's this thing that everybody wants to see, but very often, almost as soon as you've seen it, you kind of wish that you hadn't seen it. You kind of crave it and fear it in equal measure. It's always been like that, but as you say, now people are more alive to it, they're more sensitive to it than they ever have been before. I remember the worst one I've seen from ringside was on the undercard of AJ Usyk at Tottenham, and Callum Smith knocked out a fighter called Lennon Castillo. Brilliant punch. We had a great view of it, me and Matt Macklin. Beautiful right hand, and you explode with that, and then he's lying on his back and his leg starts twitching. And all of a sudden, it's just a completely different story, because you're looking at somebody, without wishing to try and dramatise anything, you don't know whether they're alive or dead. You could be watching somebody dying. Yeah. It's as simple as that, because boxing is that serious.
Do you have a favourite knockout?
It probably is Froch Groves, because that is the perfect knockout in so many ways. It's a beautifully delivered punch. But it's the scale of the event, the fact that it was Froch's last ever punch thrown in the ring. He was always one of my favourites, Carl, which he takes great amusement in when I told him that. But he genuinely always was, because he was great to watch. But he was a textbook punch. It finished his career, as it turned out. As it turned out, it absolutely didn't finish George's. But a key part of it is that people were able to enjoy that one guilt-free, because a few seconds later, Groves somehow managed to get back to his feet. Too late for the referee to allow him to continue, but he got back to his feet. And so you could watch that and savour it and enjoy it without any of that guilt that often comes with it.
There's people in there that can stop the fight, the trainers by sort of throwing the towel in, or the referees by, you know, just getting between the fighters. And so they have a responsibility as well, because you could argue they could rob you of a knockout. But I'm sure, what was the attitude? Let's start with the trainers. When you spoke to trainers about the knockout, what was their feeling around?
Well, it's a really conflicting thing for them, because obviously they want their fighter to knock people out. They want to win by knockout, because you don't go to the judges. It's decisive. It's over. It's done. There's no argument. There's no coming back from it. But they also desperately don't want their fighter to be knocked out. But if you want someone to be successful, if you want your boxer to be successful, you have to allow themselves to put themselves in danger. It's just identifying that fine line between, do they still have a chance of winning, even if they're in there under heavy fire, or not? And if it gets to the point where you feel they can't win anymore, then you have to pull them out. But you have to allow them to put themselves in danger to be in that situation. And it's a really, really, really difficult decision. It's a terrible decision to have to make a lot of the time.
And the referees have got a bit of a distance on it. They've got kind of no skin in the game. They've got no relationship, as you like, with the boxers. So it's, you know, they've got a different take on it, I guess.
They do, but it's not that different, because they know that this is hugely important for boxers. The welfare of the fighter will be their overriding number one concern, but it's not their only concern.
Yeah.
When I spoke to them, they admit that you have to look at, you know, where are you in the fight? You know, the context of the fight. The bigger the fight, the bigger reward for the win. That does play a part. And also the fact that this is entertainment. And they know what people have come to see. And they know that, you know, they know what happens when people feel like they've been robbed of a conclusive finish. Like that first fight between Carl Froch and George Groves. That's what fueled the rematch in a lot of ways. But it was a controversial ending, and people felt unsatisfied that they didn't absolutely know for certain what would have happened, because as kind of brutal as it might sound in boxing, a knockout is often the natural conclusion.
It's interesting. Probably one of the most famous knockout photographs is the Muhammad Ali Cleveland Williams fight, isn't it? The aerial shot, Neil Leaford's shot, which was taken on a remote camera from above the ring, where
Watkins is splayed out and Ali's just walking away with arms in the air. It's just one of those iconic, it's one of the great iconic sporting photos, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, because it's that's it right there. You know, you've got someone on their back and you've got someone in that moment of victory, and it doesn't get any more simple than that. And one thing that boxing's always had going for it over any other sport is that the dynamic of a fight is something that any single person in the world can understand. Everyone knows what's happened there when they see that picture. They know the situation at play. Every other sport, you have to explain it to a degree. I remember seeing a doc with David Beckham where he was going into the Amazon to play football, and he finds himself in a village where the people there don't know what football is. And for the first time ever, he has to explain to them what football is and what he is as a footballer. And it's just a really, really difficult thing to do. Whereas with fighting, everybody knows what a fight is. Everybody does. And so that image of Ali and Williams, everybody understands what has happened there.
And you talk about coming back from a knockout, and you talk about Ricky Hatton. And Ricky, you know, had those two big defeats, didn't he, that were knockouts that really knocked him for six in more ways than one, mentally as well, because it's the kind of machismo of it as well, and the embarrassment that a fighter often feels when they're, you know, it's pretty raw, isn't it, be lying there splayed out on the canvas.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that was one thing I was really keen to discover, is that what is it that they're afraid of? It's not physical pain. They're not afraid of that. Johnny Nelson was really interesting on this too. His view is that fighters should be more concerned about that and use that as their motivation for self-preservation. But it isn't that. It's the humiliation of it. It's the embarrassment of it. It's ego. It's the damage to the ego. That's what they fear more than anything else, because it is just such a deeply personal and comprehensive way to lose. There's no real explaining it. And getting over it is difficult. You have to sell it to yourself as best you can, come up with any reason as to why it could have happened. And sometimes they're bizarre and outlandish, short of my opponent was better than me, because that doesn't work. Yeah. That just does not work if you're going to recuperate from it. But it's a really hard road back from it. And some fighters don't ever really get over it. Others just seem to be able to manage to just shrug it off, but it's a really individual thing.
And there's those punches that fighters land that you think, well, they're not getting up from that, and they do. I guess in recent years, it's the Wilder Fury fight. Yeah. You know, when you think you've landed a knockout shot, it's the famous old Ali Foreman fight, when Foreman hits Ali with a shot, and he thinks that he's going down, and he says, "Is that the best you've got, George?" Yeah. And he said, "I kind of knew in that moment I'd lost." You know, so I suppose mentally, that can have an effect on you as well.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. The ability to survive a knockout is Teddy Atlas is really interesting on this, and I spoke to Neil Scott, who's a doctor with the British Boxing Board of Control, and I was trying to ask him basically, how do you explain why some people are more difficult to knock out than others? And he just said there is no explaining that. If you assume that everybody's trained really hard, which at the top level they have, why one person will get knocked out and somebody else won't? He said you just can't. You can't explain that. And Teddy talks about the refusal to be knocked out, essentially, the refusal to oblige the knockout. And if you hit somebody as hard as you can, yeah, and down they go, but then they get back up again, that can be completely demoralising.
I suppose on a very basic level, if you knock someone out, it means you're not going to be punched in the face yourself anymore. Yeah. So on a very basic level, it's good news, isn't it?
Yeah, and when you talk to fighters about winning by knockout, you imagine, or people will often imagine, that it will be this incredible moment. And the one I tried to liken it to with a lot of fighters, but they hadn't seen the film, so it didn't work, is The Quickening in Highlander. Which is a mid-80s film, so this immediately excludes any of your younger listeners. Yeah. But essentially, they fight sword fights. And when you win this sword fight, thunder and lightning, windows smash, energy bolts get channeled through your body, you sink to your knees. It's this massive, massive thing. And you kind of feel like, yeah, that should be what it feels like to win by knockout. But generally, it's just relief.
Yeah,
it's just relief that it's not you.
Yeah.
Because, you know, without wishing to be too crude, you know, you're in this gunfight and you're just relieved you're not dead.
Yeah,
it's as simple as that. And so it's not really, it can be euphoric, but it's the relief that fuels the euphoria for fighters. Or they just don't really know what to do at all. Tony Bellew said to me after he knocked out Makabu at Goodison Park, he just didn't know what to do.
Now, you took the traditional route to boxing commentator by doing a classics degree, and which is the way that most of them generally get into it. But you do, you get a bit of mythology in there, don't you, in the book, I noticed?
Yeah, so there was, is this the first time it's ever happened in my entire career? But just to kind of give people an example of how far back this goes, in the Iliad, in the 23rd book of the Iliad, which, you know, depends on whether you think that happened at all, but yeah. But people think that it probably about, you know, 1184 or around about, there's a fight between Epeius and Euryalus at some funeral games for a fallen Greek hero, and there's a really good description by Homer of a knockout, right. And you read it and it's just not, it just stands a test of time, you know. Wow. This has been going on for a really, really long time, and boxing kind of, or fighting, predates by a long, long way our kind of modern acceptance or understanding of what sport is, because team sports, the ones that we follow now, cricket, football, rugby, they are very, very recent compared to pugilism, which stretches back, you know, forever, really.
I remember that knockout. I think he took a dive.
I mean, you were there, weren't you?
Yeah, I was, yeah.
Andy went to that one. Yeah, it was a crack. It was a good night out, wasn't it?
It was.
You can always sling a bit of Homer into your next boxing commentary. That'll be good. Yeah. So the book's not out. It's out at the end of May, is that
end
right?
End of May, yeah. So we decided it would be a good idea to do it to coincide with the 10th anniversary of Frotch Groves, which is one of the ones I talk about. It's by no means the only one. But that seemed like a decent time for it. So it's available via pre-order now. But yeah. I just thought I'd get out and talk about it as much as I could this month, because next month's really, really busy.
Okay, Aurum Books, not Bob Aurum, of course.
That's very good.
Aurum.
don't explain the headline.
No, I don't explain the headline. The Knockout, Sport's Most Decisive Moment by Andy Clark, as he said, available at the end of end of May. But I'm really enjoying it, and it's a cracking read, so well
great,
done.
Thanks.
Really,
I'll send you some more copies.
Really interesting, really interesting subject.
The Hawksby and Jacobs Daily Podcast.
At the back of our chat with Andy Clark, we're now being regaled with tales from the listeners of being knocked out, but in slightly not in the ring.
No, obviously.
I was knocked out by my gran at the age of 16, says Darren. We were messing around in the lounge and she swung her carrier bag at me, forgetting that she had a jar of Mrs. Elwood's pickles inside.
Oh, dear.
Knocked me spark out.
The Hawksby and Jacobs Daily Podcast.
We asked you earlier on, are there any other sporting events in which you win a jacket? And he was telling us that Scottie Scheffler added a tartan jacket to his green jacket, having won a tournament at the weekend. And quite a few people in the world of golf, it seems, just for laughs,
oh yeah,
because of the Ryder Cup, do it. Where's this one? I'm going to put a name on this. Our annual golf trip, the Cats Club Championship winner, obtains the lilac jacket. It's a lilac velvet number. On the first trip, one of the golfers wore an ill-fitting lilac golf top, which inspired the prize. We head to France this Friday to play for this year's comp. Wish us luck. We do wish you luck. Thank you very much for that.
Presumably it's the same jacket every year. They don't buy a new...
No, I think they just... Because you wear it for the year, then you ceremonially hand it on. Me and a few mates go to Spain annually to play for the Spanish jacket. It doesn't go into any more detail than that. It's like a little Matador's one. Presented to the winner, they have to wear it until they get home. Yeah. It's highly coveted, says Si in North Wales. And if I don't know, Andy, you can maybe be able to stand this up. Lorraine in Burnley says, if you get to the NFL Hall of Fame, you get a gold jacket.
Oh, I've never heard that.
No, okay. I wasn't aware of that. And, of course, Lee couldn't resist it. Maybe a Wednesday fan. If Sheffield United fall any further, they'll need a life jacket. So
very good.
Thank you very much for that. So we're going to reflect once again. You know, so often is the case around the London Marathon, we find out weird and wonderful ways that people completed the course. And right up there is our next guest, who is a vintner, a wine connoisseur.
Yeah.
Buyer and a man who knows his stuff, and decided to incorporate his great love of wine into the London Marathon by having a little slurp on each mile of the course. On the face of it, that doesn't sound like the perfect way to refuel for 26 miles of running. But we're delighted to say that the man who did it, Tom Gilby, joins us now. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Paul. How are you?
Yes. Yeah. How are you? More to the point. I mean, it's.
Such a great idea, this.
Is this the first time you've sort of run and drunk wine?
Well, yes, it's the first time I've run and drunk wine. I have done a marathon, but a million years ago in 1996, so I'd forgotten the pain.
So where did the idea come? Was it your idea?
No, it was my son's idea. He's 26, and he said, Dad, you're probably not going to win it, and there's a lot of people who'll do a better time than you. you're 52 years old and you know about wine, so I've got a great idea. And so I said, right, I'm game.
And you had a friend on every mile, did you? Had a bottle there that they wouldn't reveal and you had to guess what you were drinking.
Indeed, and some of them still are friends, but the ones that were around the Isle of Dogs with the sort of petrol station wines are no longer friends.
Oh dear, I see.
So yeah, how did they go about choosing? Did you give them carte blanche to choose the wines they wanted to choose?
They had carte blanche, and if they were too lazy, my son got them something. And I said to my son 3 days just beforehand, please just tell me what they are, because this is difficult enough as it is. And he said, no, we're going to do this proper.
So how did you train for this? Did you do this during training or just did normal marathon training?
No, Andy, I was most worried about the wine, because if I'd have fluffed the run, that's fine. But if I'd have fluffed the wines, that would have been a problem.
Yes, so, career threatening, oh, yeah, of course, right. I guess, yeah.
Well, I knew I could do a wine at 10K and get most of it right, but beyond that was a bit of an adventure.
Yeah, because I suppose in the end, your mouth's drying up, you're running, you're obviously taking on water as well. All these little things that may affect the palate when you're trying to guess these things, it makes it a lot harder, doesn't it, I guess?
Well, particularly once you shove a Lucozade gel in there, definitely. That really...
So what was the best wine you encountered? What did they put up for you, your friends?
Well, they stacked the good wines early, so I was lulled into a full sense of security, and I hit a Barolo at wine 4, and I thought, this is going to be okay. Mm. It had a lot of nice tannin and gave me the grunt to carry on.
But then there was some cooking wine at some point, was there? What was the worst?
The worst was Jamshed on stop 14, which is somewhere around the Isle of Dogs that I've never been to before, and I recommend that no one ever goes there with Jamshed again.
Very popular supermarket wine, though, of course, Tom, isn't it? The Jamshed. You're clearly not a fan.
Not good for marathons. Oh, okay.
And were some so good, rather than just have a sip? I would take it you were drinking.
Well, nice Petrus, wasn't it?
Yeah, Petrus stations. Yes.
I wish some of the good ones went down and the bad ones went on the road.
Yeah. It's been pointed out by management here that this is not massively impressive, because Alan Brazil, our morning show presenter, has been having a drink in each ad break for the last 20 years. that is very true. That is very true. So what was your time like? How do you think the wine consumption affected your time, Tom?
Well, no, I think, it was 4:41, and most importantly, I finished. And I was going to do 26 wines, but I couldn't find my end station, which had the nice glass of fizz, so I had to have that later.
Right, okay.
25 wines, but I raised a lot of money for an amazing course.
Yeah, tell us more about that. Who are you raising money for?
Well, I was running for Sober House Hospice, who looked after my mum in her last few days of life, and they're an amazing team, and the Just Giving page has just been clocking over throughout these last 3 days. I could not have asked for anything more fun and more amazing.
That's fantastic.
You're up to about 13 grand the last time I saw.
That's excellent.
No, Andy was 17 and a half.
Wow.
Absolutely brilliant.
That's good to hear. So we will, from our social media site, we'll put a link out, Tom, to what you did. So any plans to do it again? Will you do Boston, take on some American wines, etc., or sort of Barcelona? You get some decent wine there, I would imagine.
You get some very decent wine. I might do it sitting down, though. So in answer to your question, I'm done on running with wine. But if it's to say, shall I do it? I'd say 100%. Have a go.
And you've, since the race, you've had a chance. Have you gone back and you've tried some wine? It doesn't taste any difference. You're not sort of triggering. You don't see yourself halfway around the Isle of Dogs sweating cobs, and it doesn't bring back unpleasant memories and have put you off of wine forever.
Yeah, well, Jamshed still tastes like Jamshed.
The poor old Jamshed today.
I don't think
they'll be sponsoring you by the sound of it, but maybe they will. Maybe they're just the decent thing to do. Look, good to talk to you, Tom. Congratulations. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, gents, very much.
There we are. Tom Gilby there, wine connoisseur, vintner. And marathon runner, and we will put out
the essence of the London Marathon.
Yeah, sort of mad stuff like that. I mean, you'd say don't try that at home, because it's not the way to refuel. But
there's that beer run, isn't there? Beer mile, I think it's called.
Yeah, I mean, a mile. It's not the beer marathon, is it? No, not really. Marning. That would be that as well.
Yeah, the single malt marathon. That would be good.
Do you think so? I don't think it would be. 26 drams.
It would do for me.
Wow. Yeah. Not a great idea.
The Hawksby and Jacobs Daily Podcast.
Well, there we are. That's where it all unfolded today. I'm back with Charlie tomorrow to reflect on all the football and build up to Brighton City. And you're back on Friday.
No, I'm back tomorrow afternoon with the birthday spread.
Oh, of course, the birthday spread, yeah. Do hope you can join us from one. If not, the podcast is always available at four. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the Hawksby and Jacobs Daily Podcast. Hear the guys every weekday between 1 and 4 p.m. on TalkSport.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.